Lecture 7, The Industrialized City and the Machine Vision.
I'd like to call this lecture The Industrialized City and the Machine Vision. But before even getting into these materials, I'd like to say a word or two about perspectives and approaches to this topic. One of the issues that I think should emerge in this lecture is the variety of angles that this kind of contrastive approach to different kinds of art forms or to the language of literary criticism or the language of social criticism, these are different purchases, different fixes, different origins, different ways of seeing issues. In other words, an urban historian and a poet and a painter are not always going to respond to the same thing the same way. Now, that sounds pretty self-evident, but what I want to suggest is that let's try to bracket the term criticism today, for this lecture at least. That we tend to think that the purpose of reading and the purpose of a work of art when we examine it or respond to it is to become more critical, and that probably the artist had a critical project in mind. We frequently think of art or literature as making a statement about something, and at its most reductive, we sometimes think that there's a kind of bottom line verdict. Frequently my students will say, well, what am I supposed to take away from this text, this novel? And I'm usually hard put to answer. I'm not always sure that there is a bottom line in a lot of art. I think in many ways the work of art is simply a presentation, and I think many artists often feel that what they're talking about is simply too complicated, too rich, too multiple to have a single clear reading of it. And what I want to say even further, and here I could be a little bit out on the line, is that I think that art might be more essentially a celebration than a criticism. Even a celebration of things that we don't like. A celebration in the sense that I think King Lear is a celebration. It's a terrible story about these daughters doing in their father and about his own blindness and about the punishment, the terrible punishment he receives. Just as Oedipus is a terrible story. And yet, I think that Sophocles and Shakespeare were trying in some way to show us something of the richness, the incalculability of human experience, the kinds of things that can happen to us. These are not traps that we could avoid. There are no single lessons to be learned from that. Rather, it's an enrichment, an enlargement of our own capacities to feel and to think. And in that light, I make this remark also because I think that we are living now in a climate that is a bit tribal and a bit terrorist. That is to say, today's critical atmosphere, which is often the term that one hears bandied about a great deal, is politically correct, that it is an atmosphere in which ideological judgments, bottom line thinking, like does this text tell us something about this particular group or whatever, this is the more or less the tone of, I think, of the intellectual arena today. And I think that art is having a bad time of it because of that, because art frequently, the Maple case is one of the most obvious ones, art doesn't always come down on any politically acceptable side. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't have clear political views. I'm not trying to say that at all, or that we should waffle on them. I'm just saying that art may not ever coincide as cleanly as we might desire to our views of what the good life is or what the appropriate or best values are. Now, with that sort of tendentious preface, let's take a better look at these issues. We're talking about, really, the heyday of the 19th century city and the Industrial Revolution. And I'll start with the voice and the perspective of the urban historian, the social scientist. In this case, I'll take the man who seems to me to be the best, and that's Lewis Mumford. And when he writes about the 19th century working city, the industrialized city, he's very clear. He claims that the bankers, the industrialists, and the urban inventors created a new form of a city. And it takes over everywhere in the West, and in his view, it produced the most degraded environment that the world had ever seen in terms of sanitation, air, light, use of space. And he claims not just for the workers, who you'd expect to get the short end of the stick, but even for the leisured class and the gentry. They built themselves palatial that were essentially less, in terms of sanitation and light, less enlightened, less developed, less advanced than what people had been doing in the Middle Ages. He cites three particular principles. Again, he's a social scientist. He can enumerate principles. This is the way social science works. Three principles that are governing in these developments. One is the abolition of guilds, which have been operative as a social and economic organization since the Middle Ages. The abolition of guilds and the ensuing permanent insecurity for the working classes. The competitive, this is number two, the competitive open market for both labor and sale of goods. And three, the use of foreign dependencies as a source of raw materials and potential export market. And he adds that the quasi-religious article of belief that undergirds this system is the notion of the atomic individual, whose property, rights, freedom of choice, and free enterprise are to be protected at all costs. This is what we know as the laissez-faire system, which is essentially the capitalist system. And Mumford is making a very impassioned ethical critique of it, or looking at the kinds of urban developments in the 19th century that resulted from it. Now I'm going to read you the voice of Dickens, who's writing at the same, writing at that time that Mumford in the 20th century is talking about the 19th century city. Dickens, in his novel Hard Times, actually writes, gives us a portrait of one of these cities. He calls it Coketown. It becomes a kind of famous name for the industrialized town, city. Here's how Dickens describes Coketown. It was a town of red brick, or a brick that would have been red if the smoke and ashes had allowed it. But as matters stood, it was a town of unnatural red and black, like the painted face of a savage. It was a town of machinery and tall chimneys, out of which interminable serpents of smoke trailed themselves forever and ever, and never got uncoiled. It had a black canal in it, and a river that ran purple with ill-smelling dye, and vast piles of buildings full of windows where there was a rattling and a trembling all day long, and where the piston of the steam engine worked monotonously up and down like the head of an elephant in a state of melancholy madness. It contained several large streets, all very like one another, and many small streets, still more like one another, inhabited by people equally like one another, who all went in and out at the same hours, with the same sound, upon the same pavements, to do the same work, and to whom every day was the same as yesterday and tomorrow, and every year the counterpart of the last and the next. Here, what a different kind of language this is in comparison to Mumford's list of the organizing principles that account for this system. Maybe we're talking about thinking versus imagination, or ways in which one assesses material, one assesses circumstances. It's fun, I think, to try to be attentive to these different registers, these different ways in which one responds to something. Now, there is a great deal of obvious moral indignation also in Dickens, but you can't miss the fact there's a lot of fun in Dickens. Dickens is enjoying these metaphors about the snake, that the coiling smoke, etc., or the melancholy elephant, or that last sequence when he stresses the sameness of all these people. Of course, people have never looked the same that way. But these are the kinds of possibilities for organization, exaggeration, repetition, etc., or even that almost Turner-esque, impressionistic description of the city. You could imagine Turner or one of the French impressionists like Monet painting Coketown and finding it, I'm going to get to this in a moment, finding it rather interesting. It was red brick or brick that would have been red if the smoke and ashes. Just think visually for a moment and not morally. Now, remember my initial comment. Art, in some ways, is there to, I said celebrate, and I may have overstated it, but it's there to give us the world, not necessarily to judge the world, or not exclusively to judge the world. And this is how Dickens, later in the same book, describes the worker who is to be one of his protagonists. And I want you to hear that old myth that I started with about Theseus and the labyrinth, because you're going to hear the way we move through the labyrinth to get to this figure. In the hardest working part of Coketown, in the innermost fortifications of that ugly citadel, where nature was as strongly bricked out as killing airs and gases were bricked in, at the heart of the labyrinth of narrow courts upon courts and close streets upon streets, which had come into existence piecemeal, every piece in a violent hurry for some man, for some one man's purpose, and the whole an unnatural family, shouldering and trampling and pressing one another to death, in the last nook, the last close nook of this great exhausted receiver, where the chimneys, for want of air to make a draft, were built in an immense variety of stunted and crooked shapes, as though every house put out a sign of the kind of people who might be expected to be born in it, among the multitude of Coketown, generally called the Hands, a race who would have found more favor with some people if Providence had seen fit to make them only hands, or, like the lower creatures of the seashore, only hands and stomachs. Finally, the verb, a certain Stephen Blackpool, 40 years of age. This, too, is literary language. This is how the artist creates his labyrinth and takes you, the reader, right through its endless circuits and coils and paths and leads you at the very end of that paragraph to Stephen Blackpool. Now, when we teach our young people how to write essays in college, we don't tell them to write like that. We say, this is discursive prose, subject, verb, object, be clear, etc. What is to be served by this? This is not obfuscation. By the time you get to Stephen Blackpool, you know a lot. You know something about his environment. Dickens holds off that direct object, that man whom he wants to talk about, because he wants to feed you all of that information that's in those long sentences, those circuitous sentences, about that Coketown arrangement, so that when you get to Stephen Blackpool and the period comes at the end of the sentence, you've got something. You've got something that is bristling, that is richer than a direct kind of discursive statement could have given you. And there, too, I think, just the very use of the myth of the labyrinth testifies something to Dickens' own exuberance and the fact that this is, he's enjoying the formal challenges, the writerly challenges of depicting this man in this setting. This is part of the pleasure of art. It doesn't replace judgment. It doesn't say criticism is inappropriate. It just says this is something else also. Dickens gives us a description of the train. Now, we know from Mumford that the train, he spends several pages on this, the train rapes the industrial city, is pretty much the way he puts it. That is to say that it's one of the most classic examples of poor urban planning. They took the largest area in the middle of the city and gave it over to trains. Enormous amount of space for railway yards where nothing is really happening. They're just storing cars and engines. This, from an urban planning point of view, according to Mumford, is madness. But it said something about the industrial and capital interests of the time. The invasion into the heart of the city, its takeover of valuable space, Mumford says, and its infernal production of noise and soot. This is how Dickens, in a very brief piece, describes the train picking up two people at Coketown. I love this passage. The seizure of the station with a fit of trembling, gradually deepening to a complaint of the heart, announced the train. You know, it's an urban epilepsy. It's an urban cardiac arrest. That's the train coming in. How do we see the train? Fire and steam and smoke and red light. A hiss, a crash, a bell, and a shriek. Louisa put into one carriage, Mrs. Sparsit into another. The little station, a desert speck in the thunderstorm. They've already left it. There's something quite dazzling in that writerly presentation. The whole station trembles as if we're having a kind of biological fit. You have this extraordinary explosion of fire, steam, hiss, etc. And then there's no denotative language here. He's not simply describing what happened. He's giving us the feel of it. He's translating it into other codes, other registers, like the language of the body, etc. That's one way, again, that the artist enjoys the challenge of this kind of representation, makes us, I think, experience the train in a very vivid fashion. This is one of a very famous sequence of paintings at the same time, or maybe a decade later, by Claude Monet, called the Gare Saint-Lazare. No one, I think, had ever painted a train station before Monet did. Painters, until the late 19th century, are mostly doing pastoral things. And if they do cities, they might do grand buildings and monuments. No one had thought that a train station and a locomotive were worthy subjects of painting. Monet is utterly obsessed with this. He looks at those two engines, and he does not consider them to be violent juggernauts wrecking the quality of urban life. He finds them instead to be fascinating objects. He is alive to the power that they have, the kind of obvious mechanical power. He's interested in the shapes that they make. I think that he even regards the smoke that they produce, which in 1991 we must think of as pollution. He thinks of that as a fascinating visual challenge. And if you think of Monet's work, those wonderful paintings, late paintings, of Parliament in England, the Houses of Parliament over the Thames, where you can hardly see anything. We who know something about smog in Los Angeles and things like that, we have a mixed view of that. For Monet, that sense of an environment where you can't see clear, maybe morally disturbing, but visually it's intriguing to show how those forms shimmer and how you have this kind of landscape where everything is sort of half concealed. Likewise, Monet is very much attracted to this remarkable structure itself, the Gare Saint-Lazare, the actual station with its glass facades, etc. So I'm suggesting that there's not a hint of criticism in that painting by Monet. He instead wants to render something of the excitement of the arrival of locomotives and of train stations in the city. He is not an urban critic. Now, of course, when the individual automobile arrived on the scene, you can imagine that the train lost a certain amount of its pizzazz. And then when the airplane came, the trains, probably in the eyes of many people, seem rather quaint. It's interesting. We're talking about machines and how they impact on cities. Today, with the threat of gridlock, both at airports and with cars and traffic, I think that the train is regarded by many people as one of the most promising forms of locomotion and travel. It's regaining perhaps some of the magic that it had in Monet's eye, and perhaps even in Dickens' eye. And if you think, I don't think America is in the lead here, you think of countries like France with their TGV and the experiments that are being done in most of Europe to create these high-speed trains, etc., that it's interesting to watch the loops that these kinds of engines and these kinds of modes of vehicular motion change, how they change, how they evolve, how they return. I want to move forward now to the 1920s, which I think is the heyday of the excitement over the machine, and I'm thinking of movements like futurism, vorticism in Italy, and I want to consider a couple of figures here who are rather different from each other. The first is a painter. Can we have the next painting? Fernand Léger. And Léger saw in the machine a mode of extraordinary elegance and beauty that was unmatched in history. The surfaces of the machine, the precision fittings of the machine. Notice here, this is called the Mechanic, done in 1919, or 1920 actually. This man, this mechanic, a mechanic of course would be Léger's kind of guy. I mean, he's a man who works with machines. He's obviously a composite of machines. Léger has understood that the human body can easily, and in not in any pejorative sense, be thought of as an assemblage of interlocking parts. And so we have that body with its the way the fingers look like they're tubes that are attached to other containers, and then that background, which is really non-representational, the wonderful hair, it's hard to see in this presentation of it, which looks exactly like a record, shiny sheen, black sheen to it. This figure is totally a figure of the industrial mechanical age, and yet, in some important ways, it seems to me, this figure looks timeless, too. It looks almost like the kind of hieratic, like an Egyptian bas-relief or something like that. It looks like a figure who will stand as marking an entire culture. There's something classic about this painting as well. Let's go to the next one, which is called The City. Here is Léger loved the city. He thought that the city was the greatest challenge to formal design and to color that one could imagine. He saw it as a place that was totally celebratory. He uses color here in non-representational ways. He loves what you see in the city. He loves the traffic lights. He loves advertising, posters. He loves those shop windows where things are visible. And so what we see here is nothing sort of but assemblages. Girders, we've got some of those. He likes construction. Some of his later paintings have plenty of that. We can see the influence of the traffic lights, stairways where we don't know exactly where they're going, shadows of figures, a little bit ominous. There's a figure who looks like he's hanging from a wire at some point. That's not exactly pleasing. Derricks that are in parts of this. But above all, there's a kind of gaudiness in this. Gaudiness meant as a praiseworthy term, a sense of vibrancy of just color and mechanical forms, and then these figures that are like robots that descend or the stairs or mount the stairs in the middle of this canvas. This for Léger is an exciting portrayal. This is an exciting set of possibilities of urban but also visual development. He thinks of the city as a great challenge for the artist to finally cut the cord with nature and to cut the cord with the Renaissance tradition. He thinks that notions such as human scale, the golden mean, things that have been with painters since the Renaissance, it's now time to regard them as obsolete. So there's something celebratory, and I think for us today, 70 years later, something a little bit quaint in the kind of optimism that we see in Léger's view of the world and his confidence that the machine ushers in an era of precision, of beauty. He's not much concerned with potential nightmares and problems. I'd like to refer now to another text from the same period that I don't know if you know or not. It's rather famous in film history. It's a Russian film by the filmmaker Ziga Vertov, and it's called The Man with the Movie Camera. It's done in the 20s, and it's a non-narrative film. There's no story in it, and it's a full-length film about one day in the life of Moscow. And it's a fascinating film. It's utterly celebratory. It concentrates on all the machines of the city, and those machines include the buses, and it includes also the machines of industry, the trolleys, but also sewing machines, faucets that you turn on. We even have one sequence where a woman is brushing her teeth, combing her hair. For Vertov, those two are implements, little machines that people use to make their life work. And we begin to see that all of Moscow, for him, is one extended machine. He starts with buses that are trolleys that come out of their openings, and then we see the birth of a child coming out of a mother's body, and we can't miss the fact that for him, these are entries and exits. These are all kind of mechanical systems at work and that promote life. Again, nothing disturbing for him in any of this. It's called The Man with the Movie Camera because the machine that he loves the most is the machine that allows him to do this. It's the camera. And so what we have are wonderful scenes of a man in a car racing next to other people, and he's got this huge camera, and he's trying to photograph the people in the car next to him. And, of course, if we're watching it, there's somebody else in another car photographing him, or we couldn't see it at all. And he wants to really, I think, push the prowess of his own medium, of the camera, of his own machinery, so that he shows us that the camera is capable of doing things that the human eye cannot do. So, for example, he'll take certain scenes and he'll put them in slow motion. And we're all accustomed to that because we know the cameras can do it. But you cannot command your retina or your eye muscles to do that. And he fast-forwards things and he puts them in reverse. Obviously, with our machines today and our VCRs, we can do that. But we can't do it unaided. These are the ways in which the machine enhances, intensifies perception, makes things available to us that unaided on our own we couldn't get. And in some cases, he puts the machines in places where you couldn't get. For example, and it's wacky, he puts the machine on the railroad tracks and has the train go over it. So the machine photographs the train. Short of being very, very small or being very crazy, most of us couldn't do something like that. And he also photographs things that are, strictly speaking, impossible. He superimposes images. So we see in these trolley lines and the trolleys that are moving, they go right through each other. This can be done with the camera. If it were done in reality, you'd have corpses all over the place. All of this is part of the excitement and the kind of power of the machine that he is really enjoying depicting. And I think part of that, by the way, that exuberance is visible still with us today. If you've ever seen Beaubourg in Paris, and a great deal of other buildings like that, where there is that same sense of appetite for showing mechanical forms, showing the pipes, showing the ducts, painting them different colors. Beaubourg comes directly out of Léger. It comes out of Vertov. It's a way, and we call it honest craftsmanship. The architects who do that, we want to have the surfaces show. We don't want to disguise the functions of these buildings. I'm going to mention one more film. that is done at the same time and that may be more familiar to you. And that's Fritz Lang's film, Metropolis, which has been remade in a modern version of it as well. It's the same film, but they've added a sepia color to it, and they have put it to rock music. And I think it's just as interesting in the new version. Now, this film is a very moral film in some ways. It's a narrative film. It's telling a story. It's about the master of Metropolis. That's what this man's title is. And Metropolis is the city that this man controls. He's running something like a slave labor industrial city. And the purpose of the film, the story that it's going to tell, is to show that this man has to learn that his workers, who work around the clock, underground, in an underground workplace, performing endlessly the same mechanical, specialized labor, he has to learn that they are humans rather than machines. And the agency of this change is to be his son, who will fall in love with this woman, Maria, who is very saintly, very Christian. She works tirelessly to explain to the proletariat that they must accept these conditions, they will get their reward in heaven. It's a very conservative line that's being pushed in this film. Lang is making this film at the time of a great deal of urban unrest in the wake of the Russian Revolution, and these are the years preceding the Second World War. And he wants, I think, to put forth, at least on the surface, a fairly paternalistic kind of moral, which is to say that if the person who runs the factories understands the needs of the workers, and if there's someone there to explain to these people that they shouldn't riot, they shouldn't go on strike, etc., then all things can be resolved. Now, if it were just that, it wouldn't be a very interesting film, and I wouldn't be telling you about it. There's this other character in the film who is a mad scientist. His name is Rotwang. And Rotwang is enlisted to speed up events a little bit. They're worried that the workers are still going to get out of line. So Rotwang invents a robot, fabricates a robot. And the purpose of this is that this robot is going to take Maria out of action. They don't seem to understand that Maria is what's keeping the lid on. They're going to take her out of action. And so Rotwang is working for the master of Metropolis. And so we have this actual robot. It's quite beautiful. It's a sort of an icon that is important in film history. And what they do, you've seen this in horror films, they capture Maria, they tie her up on a bed, and then they put little cords they wire her up to the robot, turn on the machines, and then, of course, the robot becomes Maria. The robot looks exactly like Maria. It's the same actress who plays the role. This is the bad Maria, not the good Maria. She really does wacky things. She has a mind of her own, it seems like. She turns into a total vamp, not the kind of Christian, sweet, forgiving figure in the past, but instead she incites all the men around her into a frenzy. We see her inciting sexual orgies with gentlemen in tuxedos, who are presumably the elite who are running these factories, and we also see her inciting the workers to this kind of total riot. They're going to blow up the place. So in terms of what the master of Metropolis must want, this is certainly not the right result. But that's the way the film proceeds. And we have these extraordinary scenes of violence, that everything goes utterly wild, that the gray-clad anonymous workers, who are all dressed in these uniforms, they can't tell any of them apart, start storming the streets, and there's total pandemonium. A lot of apocalyptic scenes. Machines all blow up. By the way, the machines are extraordinary in this set. The machines. One is a clock that is virtually crucifying the worker. It's a 10-hour clock. And the worker is hanging on to the hands of the clock. And it's a lot of crucifixion imagery. Like, it's a way of sort of showing graphically being crucified by your job, by the clock time that you put in. But anyhow, these apocalyptic moments are not only the machines blowing up and exploding and things like that, but also a river explodes, and so the whole underground workplace is beginning to be flooded. And all of this is finally resolved at the end, because the good Maria is saved by the son, and reconciliation takes. It ends with this totally corny handshake between the master of Metropolis and the foreman, or the man who was leading the workers. Now, here's why I want to talk about that film. Fritz Lang may have thought that the machine was the instrument of oppression for these workers. But if you've ever seen this film, and I hope you've been able to catch this by some of the things I was saying about it, he's awed and challenged by the machines, just as Vertov was. He is awed by the challenge of making a set that could render an entire mechanical city. One of the sets, one of the machines, all of a sudden transforms into Moloch that begins to devour workers. And even that, there's a great deal of visual excitement in watching this thing happen, because only film can make that transformation happen to us. Otherwise, it's just a metaphor for us. There are hallucinatory scenes of the city, of the future, the planes flying back and forth between buildings, with this whole city underground, which couldn't really have existed in the 1920s. And what about the robot? The robot itself is utterly prophetic. It is the natural result of an economic system where there is total division of labor and where the work itself has become so specialized and automated that the worker is reduced to a machine. The logical consequence is, build a robot. Now, that doesn't surprise anybody today. We know who's putting the cars together. We know that in today's labor system, automated labor is here. But Lang's robot is more interesting than that, because we can see, whether or not Lang saw it, that the robot, the bad Maria, is an extraordinarily liberated figure. If all of a sudden you put a Freudian lens on this film, and when I show this to my students, they identify with that robot Maria. She's the one who's sexually unrepressed. She's the one who's giving the political message that today we understand, like the workers should revolt, should riot. She is the underground or the unconscious of the film in some way, even though she's a machine and a robot. She's telling all the exciting things that can't be expressed in any other way. So it's a fascinating film in its contradictions. And finally, one of my reasons for bringing it up in this lecture is that there is an urban dimension to this. That the robot, the two Marias, you don't know which one is which. This is another version, precisely, I think, of the urban anonymity of not knowing exactly who is who. And if you think that sounds hokum, think about a film like Blade Runner, where we have another version of this, where we have the mutants, or we have whatever they're called, the androids, the people who look like people but aren't. It's like the invasion of the body snatchers, except that they're mechanical. They've been constructed. We don't know which they are, human or not. It is a kind of always under the surface city nightmare. But I think that in this film, we can actually see the beginnings of it. By the way, Blade Runner is very much an urban film. It's a futurist film about a darkened, polluted LA and then a cityscape inhabited by people where you don't know if they're mechanical or human. Well, that's one way of talking about representations of the machine in film and in painting and in urban theory, and trying to give you some sense of how different they might be, how they don't necessarily share a common moral view, and that makes it perhaps more confusing, but I also think more interesting. I want in the rest of this lecture to attend to the other side of this equation, which is not the machines, but the kind of city they produce and the kind of human response to them. I've mentioned Georg Simmel in the past as a very prominent urban theorist, even though his work goes back over half a century. And in that essay, The Metropolis and Mental Life, that I cited earlier, he makes a lot of observations that are now commonplace, but that certainly were not when he made them, which is that the city is a place of almost intolerably heightened stimuli and sensations. Every time we cross a street, our body, our minds are assaulted with possible dangers, not just the cars, but we're looking out of the corner of our eye all the time at other people, what's coming our way. That city life doesn't have the kind of laziness and routinized dimension that village life, a rural life, might have had. And what he goes on to say is that this onslaught of stimuli, this barrage of shocks, is almost intolerable, that we can't really open ourselves fully to that. And I think that what he articulates is that in order to withstand this, we start blocking it out, or we develop a certain kind of blasé attitude. We shunt it out. And this is, to me, what being street smart consists of. We tell people to keep their eyes right in front of them, not to be attentive to everything around them, at least not conspicuously or openly. The first thing you hear when you go to New York is, don't look up at the buildings or anything, because they'll pick your pocket. Don't. Eye contact, of course, is a total no-no. We all know that. all of these kinds of rules and regulations about walking the streets and saving either our lives or our sanity, in some sense, I think, are coherently relatable to Simmel's essay. And we know that people can walk right over human bodies without stopping. Now, this sense of blocking off the stimuli is in some ways present in all kinds of other materials. It's present in Eliot's great poem, The Wasteland. He talks about the human engine in that poem. He compares the human being to a waiting and throbbing taxi. He even gives us a very important episode of seduction with his carbuncular clerk and his female typist. And it's a completely mechanical, passionless seduction. And he, in that poem, in the strategy of the poem, he contrasts this rather impoverished lovemaking with the kind of splendor of erotic activity in the past, and he refers to Antony and Cleopatra, and he refers to Elizabethan England as a time when there was a greater richness in life. And this is clearly part of the urban mechanical world. It's why he compares it to throbbing, waiting taxis and human engines. These are some of the human meanings that flow from the machine age or the mechanical vision. Baudelaire, whom I've talked about a great deal, has been described as a figure who was very much open precisely to these stimuli and was not able to shut them out. Now, this whole model of stimuli coming in at us, threatening to capsize us, us developing strategies to shunt them and keep them out, this is Freud's model of the brain. This is what homeostasis is all about. Freud defines the brain as a place that maintains its balance, that's its primary activity, by keeping the stimuli of the outside world at a distance, shutting them out, buffering them out, because otherwise we would go under, we would capsize. Well, what about when that effort to protect ourselves fails? What about when the stimuli come in, are unstoppable, and I think a lot of literature shows us those things. It shows us sort of portraits of what could happen. One of the texts that I won't deal with very long is Melville's famous tale from the 1850s called Bartleby. Bartleby, I don't know if you've read it or not, it's a splendid story. It looks like Kafka, even though it's written at least 50 or 60 years before Kafka. And it's called a tale, or it was called in his original title, A Tale of Wall Street. And it's about Wall Street in the 1850s. And it looks a lot like Petersburg in Gogol and Dostoevsky. And that in this law office, all of a sudden, appears this figure, Bartleby, pale figure, always described as spectral, almost like a ghost. And his job is to be a copyist. These are the pre-Xerox days. He's to be a copyist. And the plot's very simple. He dysfunctions. He's given a mechanical job. He breaks down. He refuses to copy. He always says the same phrase over and over. I would prefer not to. He doesn't say, I won't. I would prefer not to. But the point that I really want to make with Bartleby is that in his refusal to copy, he illuminates the looniness of that law office in the first place. He refuses to be a team player, or to use biblical language, he is a kind of Lucifer on Wall Street. He says, non serviam, I will not serve. I will not play the game. And this is considered mad, including mad by the narrator of the story, who was the lawyer who still remembers all of this. Another title you could get for this story is Christ on Wall Street. This is a person who walks in, and he comes to the city of the money changers, and he says, I will not be a part of this. He refuses to copy documents. And he also commits the ultimate sin in this business locale. He refuses to work at the office, but he also refuses to leave the office. He sets up camp in the office. He lives there. The lawyer himself vacates the office. Other people come in, and they have him arrested, sent to the New York Tombs, and finally he dies. It's a wonderful story, because one of the things that it shows, I think at least, is a very modern theme, which I don't think Melville could have intended, which is that Bartleby, in a sense, is a homeless figure. He chooses to live instead of to work. And he is saying that a place where people come together has got to be a place for living, This is the antithesis of the mechanical vision, the machine vision, the productivity vision. You are how much you produce, how much you earn. You are your function. This is an existential story, even though it's written way before existentialism, where this man simply, he doesn't say a word. All he says is, I would prefer not to. He chooses to live there, flaunts the kind of humane authority of just being a living human creature. And he haunts. He dies, but he haunts. That's the reason the story is told. The lawyer cannot forget this man. He's still thinking about it. And I think, in a sense, Melville is saying that the homeless find their last home in us, in our guilt, our memory. The story just resonates with that image. Well, how would you show people being emptied by the city? I say that Bartleby's spectralness, in some sense, is what that urban setting has done to him, not just the legal operations, but living in that impersonal city that operates according to functional relationships rather than humane feeling. I'd like to look at one or two paintings to show you an instance of how the artist can render what the city does to its people. This is Munch's painting, Spring Day on the Carl Johan. It's a city street, the street romance. It's all of the bourgeois walking down the street together. It's done in an early Munch style. It doesn't look like typical Munch at all. And notice the solidity of the buildings, the sense in which these are solid figures who are representable, who have contours, and who have surfaces. Now let's go to the next one, which I think you all know. And this is Evening. It's the same setting, and notice what has happened. These people have all become spectral, mummies. Their faces have been hollowed out, eaten out. This is a march of the zombies, it seems to me, on the same street. All of the solidity that was in the early piece is gone here. There's something almost cancerously invasive here. These hollow eyes, these faces that have, that are simply like walking ghosts, like they came right out of the grave. This is a way, your eyes can't see that, but this is the way Munch can show how people turn into zombies, how those stimuli, and not just urban stimuli, how the stresses of life can do you in. Ordinarily, they're not on show. Most of our scars are hidden. But in Munch's work, it's all demonstrable. And can we go, perhaps, to the next one? Here I'm moving to a painter whom you know. This is Edward Hopper. And he is, I think, one of the great American painters about the city. This is called, it's simply called Night Windows, done in 1928. And it's very Baudelairean, I think. This is the imagination, the voyeurism. It's obviously a voyeuristic painting, but all painting in some sense is. It asks us to imagine what's there, somebody else's life. And we look in these windows. This is a kind of night marauder painting. We look at that body of the woman bent over there, but we can't see much. We have that wonderful notation of the curtains sort of flapping in the breeze. Almost conveys the sense of imaginative life here, as well as the wind. Let's look at two others, one of which you certainly know, the next one. Nighthawks, probably Hopper's most famous painting. How could you show the city as a place that makes human solitude visible? Well, you do it this way. You have this huge, elongated window, this huge bar, and these people, you can almost hear the silence of this piece. These people sitting in silence, unconnected. And if I could show, I won't, I don't have a close-up, but if I could show you the hand of the man and the woman he's with, those hands are like a fraction of an inch apart, almost touching, but not quite. And of course, that's part of the theme, I think, of this piece. Or the last one of Hopper, can we have this? This is called Morning in the City, he called it. And it says something, again, about the emptiness of urban living, and the yearning, looking out of the window versus that other one where we look in at the window. Here is the human body prepared for passion, and we sense that nothing of that type is forthcoming. Looking out at the window, at the open window, in contrast to the sterility at home. Can we turn that off now? The last figures that I want to refer to in this lecture are literary figures. Actually, I'll just take one. And it's a poet who has written some remarkable prose. It's Rilke, who's probably the greatest German poet, I think, or one of the great poets of the 20th century. And it's his one prose text called The Notebooks of Malte Lawrence Brigge. And it's actually like the sketches in German is what it says, other than notebooks. And it's a story of a poor Danish artist living in Paris. And it's modeled on Rilke's own experience in Paris when he was very poor. And what I want to cite from it are passages, just one or two, where we actually see what happens when the city comes in. When that tempo, that rhythm, that power can no longer be kept out there, where homeostasis isn't working, the brain is not keeping things at a distance. Early on, Malta says, to think I cannot give up sleeping with the window open, electric streetcars rage ringing through my room, automobiles run their way over me. It's not out there anymore, it's coming all together inside. And then the passage that I will read to you goes like this. This is a man who walks through the streets of Paris. He's poor, penniless, and he sees the derelicts, and they all speak this extraordinary language to him. He senses that their disarray, their creatural misery, their alienness, like they're belonging to a different species, signals him, makes him realize that he too is not at home in that city, and he's not. He's a Danish artist visiting Paris. But here's the way it's described. What in the world did that old woman want with me, who had crawled out of some hole, carrying the drawer of a nightstand with a few buttons and needles rolling about in it? Why did she keep walking beside me and watching me, as if she were trying to recognize me with her bleared eyes that looked as though some diseased person had spat green slime into the bloody lids? And how came that little gray woman to stand that time for a whole quarter of an hour by my side before a shop window, showing me an old long pencil that came pushing infinitely slowly out of her miserable clenched hands? Kind of scary notation, this emerging pencil, like it's a graphic language, like she's showing you that we're sister and brother in some way. And that's what he goes on to say. I pretended to look at the display in the window and not notice anything. She knew I had seen her. She knew I stood there wondering what she was really doing, for I understood quite well that the pencil in itself was of no consequence. I felt it was a sign for the initiated, a sign the outcast would know. I guess she was indicating to me that I should go somewhere or do something, and the strangest part was that I could not rid myself of the feeling there actually existed a certain compact to which this sign belonged. All of his givens have been undermined, all of his sense of his private bearings and markings, who he is, a kind of irresistible sense of kinship with these people, not given as some fine high of emotion, like what a nice guy I am, but rather given as a kind of discovery that he too is as diminished and miserable a figure as they are, that they are all outcasts in some way. Now, this may not be a happy picture of community, but I present it to you as a picture of losing one's defenses, of finding that one cannot retain one's impregnability, that the walls around us that sort of shore up our identity, socially but also epistemologically, morally, in certain cases, in intensified works of art like this, those walls come tumbling down. Thank you.